Last evening, listening to Rada, Bernier so succinctly cover many of the points which I intend to make today, I kept asking myself, what am I doing on this program? I generally am a rather confident person, but I must admit that following Joy and Rada, and then being immediately followed by our resident master of the English language, John Algio, I am slightly intimidated. But everything happens for a purpose, so thank you, John, for inviting me and giving me the opportunity to share with this group some of my ideas about the wonder and the beauty of giving and giving as a spiritual practice. Might be useful to explain to you how I did get here. This all started about 18 months ago. I was having a nice Chinese dinner with John and Adele out in Ojai, California. I just finished meeting, in fact, Robert and I just finished meeting with a committee out there that's interested in increasing their endowment and getting a better financial situation for Crotona, concerned, looking to the future, planning. So we had met with them to advise them or confer with them about that. And then I went to dinner. I also happen to have a passion for the spiritual power that's involved in giving. And so tying those two together, obviously the topic came up at dinner, and I probably got a little too bold, challenging John as to why the TS didn't put more emphasis on giving and trying to help its members understand the power of giving. And he said he thought that was a real issue that needed to be addressed, and he would put me on the program for summer school and let me address it. John's very skilled at doing that kind of thing, and so Carol and I were already booked, so I thought I had another out. I told him we were going to be in Sweden in July. That was last year, so I wouldn't be available. But anyway, he said, well, next year will do. I thought he'd forget, but he didn't forget. And so here I am to talk to you about giving as spiritual practice. And I believe this is an urgent issue for us. I would hope that maybe all of you came because you thought this was an important issue and you wanted to hear this particular presentation or think about this while you were here. But even if that wasn't your principal reason for coming to this convention, I hope that at least for the next hour, you'll have an open mind and listen to the possibilities that I believe giving can have in your life. So, on with the presentation. As one meditates on the poetry of HPB in Voice of the Silence, reads the dynamic lectures of Annie Besant, or reflects on George Arundel's description of nirvana, one is challenged to enter the path and seek to live that spiritual life which will move us more rapidly along the evolutionary trek toward perfection or oneness. We get excited and challenged as we read or study and participate in workshops or at conferences such as this one. We get glimpses of truth as we meditate. And at times, for just a moment, we experience the fullness of the void or hear the voice of the silence. But unfortunately, when it comes to the nitty-gritty task of living life day to day, we often have trouble relating our everyday issues to the esoteric teachings and experiences. It seems that in the West, we have a particularly difficult time in grasping the esoteric ideals. We're so rooted in materialism that we cannot readily make that jump from a worldly focus to a spiritual focus. Maybe in the East, because of cultural training, one can give up the self by simply meditating on the higher principles. But in the West, such a transition is not readily embraced. We need something more. The most constructive way to the spiritual life is clearly by making an inner change, which is permanent and strong and directs our outward actions through that interchange. That's the ideal. That's clear. But for many of us, a more structured approach of modifying our outward actions through discipline to eventually bring us to this interchange is a more realistic approach. And I think for most Westerners, this side over here is the one that we resonate more clearly with than this, which I see is more the Eastern tradition. So my goal in this presentation is to share two concrete steps which for me help bridge that gap between everyday world and the path to enlightenment. These are not theoretical steps, but proven techniques that have been used by many, but are not often talked about, as far as I can tell, in the TS. As Annie Besant says, self-discipline is the key to wholeness, and character is built first by contemplation of the target virtue, and then by working out of that virtue into the speech and action of daily life. These two techniques that I will discuss help one to focus on the target virtue, which I will tell you about in a minute. Two cautions. First of all, just because I find something useful doesn't mean it will be useful or necessarily relevant in your spiritual track. I fully believe that we must each follow our own dharma, and to do otherwise is folly. I'm not saying you must follow these disciplines, but I do happen to believe that they are fairly generic and would be useful to the vast majority of the TS members. Second, some of you may find the word discipline offensive, as sometimes Krishnamurti seems to, like when he says a disciplined mind cannot discover, it cannot uncover the fathomlessness. However, to me, I think this kind of statement is what I would call an esoteric extreme. What he says is very true. If you're already well along the path to enlightenment and you have conquered most of your worldly characteristics, because then living in perfection comes naturally. However, for most of us, practice is essential. And without specific discipline, growth is not possible. We learn this lesson daily. To master any skill requires practice, practice, practice. Whether your goal is to play a flute, write a symphony, be an all-pro linebacker, win the Nobel Prize, raise a child, or experience spiritual growth, few of us are born experts. And to even take a few steps toward competency requires practice. So for the next hour, I ask that you think of discipline as a very positive growth word, as does Annie Besant when she says, out of right speaking and right thinking inevitably must flow right acting. For action is only the manifestation of that which is within. That on which the mind is constantly dwelling will be that which the person shall become. So the practical disciplines are a cornerstone of spiritual growth. And the two that I will discuss are steps toward experiencing HPB's first key to open the first portal, to master the most critical paramita or virtue, which she identifies as charity or dana. Both of these actions teach charity and build in us not just habits, but over time the understanding which is essential if we're to truly become charity or dana. Now, I'm not claiming to have mastered either of these myself, but I am convinced that once I have, in whatever lifetime, I will have experienced charity and know this virtue so that I have become one with it and thus have taken the critical first step on the path. Let us explore for a few minutes the critical nature of the first step along the path. Why is charity the first step? Here I draw heavily on Rohit Mehta's book, Fullness of the Void, which in a way is a commentary on HPB's Voice of the Silence. Mehta provides an excellent explanation of why charity is the first step. And his explanation centers around the concept which HPB urged students to follow, choosing the secret path rather than the open way. The issue is, when you reach the other shore at the end of the path, will you rest in the bliss and the joy of nirvana? Or will you return to assist those beings who still suffer and toil in darkness and ignorance? That was the issue with her. And of course, HPB urges one to return. And she argues that if one enters the path through this door of charity, then this return to help others, once the journey is complete, is a given. If you've entered through this door, there can be no other path when you get to the other shore. And that's why the first step is so critical. That's why it is said that the first step is also the last step. Mehta also emphasizes another aspect of charity. He says that it's not the giving out of plenty, but the giving out of necessities that can be described as charity. In a deeper sense of the term charity, it is not the giving away of what one has, one's possessions and one's acquisitions. But the essential feature of charity is the discarding of the sense of possession. One may give away things and become a pauper in the physical or material sense. But even there, if the sense of possession is not discarded, one can cling to the possession of non-possession. The discarding of a sense of possession implies the giving up of all that one has acquired or accumulated. And the biggest acquisition that we have is not our material things, but our building up of the I-ness, the ego. Through charity, which is the shedding away of one's acquisitions, outer as well as inner, there's created a crack in the wall, the crack in the wall of one's identity, that one describes as the I. The crack becomes bigger and bigger as we practice this charity, until finally the entire wall collapses. The wall that is the I disappears, the I-ness that divides the real from the false. So now that we've established the essential nature of this first step, this charity, and understand until this step is perfected, we can make little progress along the spiritual path, then let's look at the practical aspects of how we can take some steps toward the perfection of charity. It seems to me that in the TS we tend to focus heavily on the generic concepts and generally fail to provide the practical approaches which are so essential for the Western mind. It seems that there are two extremes in modern wisdom teaching. Either we speak in generic truths, as did Krishnamurti, and leave the practical evolution completely up to the individual, or we try to teach dogma and fundamental rhetoric, as many of the fundamental organizations do, where the exact formula for spiritual growth is dictated to everyone. Neither of these seem to be exactly what we need, and I would hope that with the subject of charity, we might find this middle way that will allow us to look at generic truths and yet find practical ways that we might at least consider approaching these. If we're to understand the essence of charity as described by HPB, then we must do as she suggests and live altruism every day. In The Key to Theosophy, she says that occultism is altruism first and last. She further says that we must separate head learning from soul learning, the eye from the heart doctrine. And if we look to the masters who have lived out the heart doctrine, for example, Sri Krishna or Jesus, as models for how we might live, then what we see clearly is that a life of compassionate action is essential. As Sri Ram says, the man of compassion, of sympathy, and of love cannot refrain from action. Annie Besant expresses the same concept, saying, none are in the outer court save those who have definitely vowed themselves to service, those who have given everything and who have asked for nothing in return. I do not think that any of us here today would challenge the desirability of living in this manner. So the real question becomes, what discipline can we incorporate in our lives that will enable us to grow away from our focus on self toward a focus on others, so that we can become this person of loving action that we are destined to be, but we struggle to be? It seems that the challenge is to bring forth the true self within our being, which already has a passion for giving of the total self to the well-being of others. This higher self is buried in this person. It has a passion for giving, and yet we keep it hidden inside. The two disciplines which I believe that we can enable, that will enable us to grow the way we need to grow, that will allow us to make this transition from focus on the self to focus on others, are first, giving substantially of our material goods, and second, seeing every person or thing that we encounter each day as a manifestation of the One, deserving to be treated with compassion and love. So those are the two disciplines that I will talk about. Now, in my experience, the first of these, giving substantially of our material goods, is by far the easiest to implement and the easiest to be consistent with. Thus, I will discuss it first. I also feel that since we happen to live in a very materialistic age and are bombarded by consumerism each day, as Radha discussed with us last evening, this step of giving is the key to opening the way to the second proposed discipline. So I think we have to learn this one in order to move to this one. And then together, they bring us to what true charity is. In terms of the disciplines proposed in At the Feet of the Master, these are steps that lead to the first two discussed in that book, discrimination and desirelessness. We're challenged in At the Feet of the Master to learn to discriminate between the real and the unreal, the eternal and the fleeting. In a materialistic world, I can think of no more concrete and growing action to take than to learn that money is not real. Of course, money is not the only manifestation of the unreal in our lives. We're basically immersed in illusion. But I feel that money is a strong symbol of things and materialism. It's a strong symbol that we latch on to, and it pulls us into the unreal and separates us with a barrier from the real. So by practicing detachment from our money, the material, we're better able to focus on the real. By practicing giving of our material goods, we move toward learning to discriminate. In a similar fashion, to learn desirelessness or dispassion, we need practical steps to practice daily. Seeing everyone we encounter each day as a manifestation of the One should lead to that end. So let us look at each of these proposed disciplines in more detail. Let us turn first to the proposed discipline, giving substantially of our material goods. I've been told that theosophists are above talking about money. And I will agree that too much talk of money and budgets and needs gets old quickly. That aspect of giving is not what I'm talking about today. That's not our topic. But it is what generally comes to mind when we think of giving in the context of the TS or of any other organization. If you talk about giving, that's the organizational issues. But generally, we think of money, like I said, as an organizational issue. But I'm proposing that that's not appropriate, that we should give up that idea, and we should see it as an education issue. The TS has the responsibility to educate its members as to what concrete steps they might take to enhance their spiritual track and to help others learn what the truth is. Since I believe giving is one of the key disciplines, I would propose that the TS should be much more attentive to giving and to the task of helping its members realize the importance of the giving discipline in their lives. We each have a need to help others understand the wonder of giving. I do not believe there's any one of you that would question for a moment that giving of ourselves is a critical facet of living the spiritual life. I think we all just generally accept that. As a TS member, we commit to a life of study and of service to all people. But for some reason, we separate giving of ourselves from the giving of our money. Such a separation is not theosophical. In our world, our money is very much a part of our life and of our being. So to claim to be committed to a life of service while clinging to our material possessions creates a clear barrier to our entering the spiritual path. It is my conviction that the greatest hindrance to spiritual growth, to constructive relationships, as was talked about this morning, and to following the path in our modern world, is our love of and protection of money. You're all familiar with the phrase, "The love of money is the root of all evil." I don't intend to expound on that concept this afternoon, but if you will seriously reflect on this phrase for just a moment, I believe you will agree that our greed and our lust for things is certainly the basis for much of the conflict at a personal as well as a global level. The love of money definitely keeps us focused on the unreal rather than the real, and thus it's a major barrier to our learning discrimination. So what can we do to rise above the trap of money and possession? We can practice the discipline of non-consumerism. That ought to be easy. But the only practical way to accomplish it seems to be to escape to a monastery or live alone deep in the woods somewhere. As a nation, the United States is totally addicted to consuming. And not only are we addicted, I don't think we will rest until we draw the entire world into the trap. Several years ago, I was appalled in visiting Honduras, a true third world country, to find that the three most obvious U.S. influences on that country, it seemed to me, were cigarettes, Coca-Cola, and television. And the television was teaching these people how many other new things they must obtain immediately if they were to live happily. I knew a couple several years ago. They prided themselves in how simply they lived deep in the mountains of rural Kentucky. They felt very superior to all us folk who succumbed to the evils of advertising. Their big claim to fame was that they had never eaten any fast food. Yet only 6 weeks after moving from rural Kentucky, where they never saw fast food, they found themselves regularly drawn into the McDonald's, which they passed each day in their new city. We may have good intentions, but living as a non-consumer in a consumer's environment is very difficult. So how can we deal with this addiction to consumerism and self-gratification? Escape is clearly one way, but in my reading of the leaders of our society, I do not think that's an approach that would be recommended. They encourage us to enter the world fully, to experience the world as it is, not as we would wish it to be. Henry Alcott fully immersed himself in the Buddhist cause in Ceylon, and Annie Besant did the same for the Hindus in India. They each practiced altruism by total involvement in the causes to which they were called, rather than escape to spiritual isolation. I was intrigued recently by an article in Quest magazine last fall where Rupert Sheldrake discussed the concept of morphic resonance. He defined morphic resonance as a process whereby similar patterns of activity resonate through and across space and time to create a collective memory of right or wrong activity. His thesis is that because of morphic resonance, the more we choose to think, speak, and act in harmony with the higher principles, the easier it will be in the future for both ourselves and others to do the same. Of course, this concept's not new. It seems to resonate with much that Annie Besant wrote and spoke about. It also resonates with a lot of what Radha was speaking about. But I like the term morphic resonance and the concept that it conveys, and so I think I'll use that term. Sheldrake poses that on the opposite side of right activity, that there's right activity which can come out of morphic resonance, and on the other side is the sway of mammon. Now, right activity we could see as altruism or charity, and this is the materialism of the day, the god of money and commercial greed. And he contends that this god is at work today through our economic systems and our compulsive consumption. Sheldrake says that to ignore these destructive forces is to wander around the world blind, but he is not specific as to how we might fight back other than by pure thought, which is effective, for sure, but it's not always so easily available or within our reach. So I would submit that there is a more concrete action that we can take in response to Sheldrake's challenge. The gift of the discipline of the tithe in the Christian tradition and of charity and altruism in ancient wisdom is our opportunity to establish a positive resistance within ourselves, and then through morphic resonance with others, which can counter the negative influence of greed and envy generated by money in our society. And so through giving, we can establish morphic resonance and offset this trend to materialism and greed. At the same time, the practice of such a discipline can contribute substantially to the morphic resonance that resists such forces throughout the world. By practicing true charity, we can instill a desire and a propensity for right activity as opposed to the inappropriate and harmful activity of consumerism and mammon. Similarly, by learning to give away money and thus breaking our tie to money, though still being practical so that we're not a burden to others, we eventually can be freed from the binding chains of money which prevent our grasping the key which will allow us to open this first portal. In George Arendelle's book on Nirvana and the value of nirvanic consciousness in our lives, he says, "I must have, for the work which is and will be mine, an ever-present sense of nirvana, to inspire, to strengthen, to guide. This infiltration of nirvanic consciousness is necessary in order that, living in the world, I may keep free from its shackles. I clearly see how infinitely true it is that one cannot serve both God and mammon. And by mammon, I mean all of the lower worlds that I should have outworn. I see that I have need to readjust the value of things. End quote. Money, or the love of it, is the chain that binds us to these so-called shackles from which we must free ourselves. Of course, we must be aware, forgiving is a paradox, as is every discipline. If we give so that we can learn charity, so that we can gain nirvana, then it is all for self, and we've missed the point entirely. But if we always use the paradox argument to avoid any action, then we'll be totally paralyzed and never grow. My experience is that giving of self and money without attachment does free one from attachment to money and does allow one to begin realizing the wonder of charity. By teaching and strongly encouraging this discipline, the Theosophical Society could empower its individual members to move forward toward the path and at the same time challenge its own vision for service. From a morphic resonance perspective, such action by the Society would be a great service to the world and to the Masters. At this stage, I will be bold and assume that you're still with me and that you're considering agreeing that giving substantially of material goods needs to be a part of our educational program in the TS and in each of our lives. Then, if you agree, the question becomes, how specific should we be in encouraging others to try the discipline? My answer to that is very specific. People need guidance, especially in the area of money. And constructive guidance can be effectively given without setting forth dogma and rules that would defeat the entire effort. As we said earlier, the Jewish and Christian traditions use the law of the tithe. And yes, it turns many in those faiths off because they don't understand it. And for those outside of those traditions, it seems to be a rather self-serving practice because they too have failed to understand it. But most laws are disciplines that are deeply entrenched in the various religious traditions do have some root in the ancient wisdom. So it's worth trying to better understand this business of the tithe rather than just simply dismiss it. I've known many people who practice the discipline of giving at every level, from $1 to virtually all that they have. And of these people, everyone who gives a little or a small percentage of their income seems to miss out totally on the pure joy of giving. They are disciplined, so they give, but it's out of duty and never a freeing experience. On the other hand, those who give 10% or more of their income love the practice, or at least the ones I've known, and they see it as a freeing discipline that leads to a new level of understanding. I've never known one person who regularly practiced the discipline of giving away at least 10% that did not rejoice in the beauty and the miracle of the practice. To me, this is clear evidence of the truth of this practice and confirmation that there is something mystical about the 10% level. Below this level, below the 10% line, we experience an exoteric burden. But above this level, we experience an esoteric freedom. Annie Besant says that spiritual alchemy is a process of transmutation whereby one transmutes the forces from lower ends to higher, from gross energies to energies that are refined and spiritualized. And the tithe, in my view, is the point in giving where spiritual alchemy begins to exercise itself from money and transforms it from the lower to the higher. In an article last fall in the Theosophist, Frank Visser related several theories of truth. what truth really means has been a challenge throughout the ages. But one view of truth is that anything that is self-evident and speaks to the unprejudiced mind is truth. This first one here. Now, Visser says that the more we are able to accept intuitively theosophical teachings, the more they will influence our daily lives. This is exactly my point with giving or charity. And I believe it was HPB's basic teaching. By practicing charity, we will grow to know it intuitively as truth, and therefore live it. Another view of truth is, does it produce results? In applying this test to theosophy, Visser says, if theosophy makes us content and cheerful amidst the darkness of life, then theosophy is true, at least for us. As I apply this criteria to giving, I come to the same conclusion. Substantial giving brings contentment and cheerfulness in a dark world. Meager giving brings frustration and resentment and more darkness. Substantial giving also begins to positively shape one's worldview. As an example of this, last fall, before our local study meeting started one evening, several of us were discussing the merits of feng shui. Feng shui is the study of arranging one's house or property to provide for the right flow of energy for the best advantage. And one woman commented that she had closed up a door in her house when she learned that if the back door was immediately across from the front door, the money flowed right through the house. Her point was, she said she had closed hers. Her point was that Carol and I should get ours closed up quickly because we had the same situation. And if we would close it, then we could catch more money and keep it for ourselves. My thought was, wow, this is great. Let's leave it open all the time. And then the money can just flow. It won't even slow down. It'll just move straight through our lives into the world where it can serve. Much of the Christian tradition and doctrine may have become distorted over the years. But this is one discipline that rings true and is implied and assumed in all traditions through the concept of altruism. All we possess belongs to the universe and is only under our temporary care. So in fact, our possessions are not ours, and the sooner we learn to treat them as part of the greater whole, the sooner we can begin to allow our true selves to emerge. In the ultimate, as we grow in charity by practicing the discipline of giving, we eventually understand the truth. All that we have belongs to the universe because we are part of the one and it is part of the one. In possessing and calling something ours, we divide and separate, thus disrupting the harmony of the one. So the ultimate is to own nothing, but to share all. And I believe the only way to ever get to this level of understanding is by practicing the discipline of giving substantially of all that we have, including time, talents, love, and yes, money. In this practice of giving, we experience wonder, gradually grow in understanding, and eventually gain wisdom, so that as more and more is given, we approach the full realization that all is, in fact, one. Now, before moving to the second discipline, I think a brief period of reflection might be of value in helping us to solidify the concept of giving in our minds. For we must remember that the mind is the slayer of the real. So the mind will resist this concept of the power of giving. We need to practice, like we started with. We need to practice, 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 letting our minds learn to think this way. So I would ask that you close your eyes, relax. Take a couple of deep breaths. Center yourself and reflect on a few quotes as I read them. First, from Khalil Gibran, "Money is like a stringed instrument. He who does not know how to use it properly will hear only discordant music. Money is like love. It kills slowly and painfully the one who withholds it, and it enlivens the other who turns it upon his fellow men." From the New Testament, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures upon earth, for where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will hold to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and mammon." From Sri Ram, "True sacrifice is utmost joy, the most vitalizing passion that one can possibly experience. The idea of giving up associated with sacrifice arises only because of the attachment and the sense of possession which suffers in the giving." From the Voice of the Silence, "Armed with the key of charity, of love and tender mercy, thou art secure before the gate of Dana, the gate that standeth at the entrance to the path." From the Creative Silence, "If giving is not a joy, it is no giving at all. Charity must exist in the continuous background of bliss, so that the giver is not even conscious that he is giving. The giving is anonymous because the giver is lost in the act of giving." Thank you. Now let us briefly turn to the second discipline. In the extreme, it is essentially one with the first. But in application, there seems to be a value in separating the two for practice and focus. Eventually, they will merge, no doubt. But in the beginning, merger can bring chaos and confusion, so I think it's best to keep them separated. And the second is seeing every person or thing that we encounter each day as a manifestation of the One, deserving to be treated with compassion and love. And as I said, I think this one is more difficult. This is the model which was portrayed to us in the New Testament through the actions and ministry of the Master Jesus. This model for living at one with the universe is just as valid today as it was useful then. What has always struck me most vividly about the Jesus model is that he did not go out seeking to convert people to become his followers. He did not promote his ideas and beliefs. He simply dealt with life as it came to him and ministered to those whom he encountered daily. He spoke the truth when it was appropriate. Further, if someone asked him to be healed, he didn't preach a sermon or hold a discussion meeting to decide if there was any value in healing. He simply met the specified need and went on his way. So the Jesus model teaches the practical aspects of living the golden rule, which is generally cited as a characteristic of Christianity, but is known to exist in all religions. Theosophists, understanding that acting in this manner is essential. I mean, we understand this. This is basic. We know that doing unto others as you would have them do unto you is something we should practice. But if we're to overcome our preoccupation with self, we must really live this and not just preach it or think about it. But we must live it if we're to overcome ourselves. Basically, we realize that the golden rule is more than a simple moral injunction. It is, in fact, an alternative statement of HPB's first key to the path, which she took from the ancient wisdom. It is, in fact, another example of spiritual alchemy, where lower actions are transmuted into spiritual experiences. Now, how can we learn to discipline ourselves to such an extent that we truly live in such a loving, caring relationship with others? The most effective way, I think, is to break it down into smaller steps. But these many steps must be addressed in the correct order. First, each of us must fully accept that we are the one. Now, this is not simple. Often it's useful to tell ourselves each morning upon rising that we are a part of the one. And this might be done by something like quoting, "More radiant than the sun, purer than the snow, subtler than ether is the self, the spirit of the heart. I am that self am I." That is a way. But whatever you use to trigger this concept, to get in firmly fixed in your mind that you are part of the one. Then secondly, we can begin to practice the discipline within our family, so that each time we see or think of a particular family member, we immediately experience the one. Think of the difference that can make in our lives. If every time we saw our spouse or our children or our parents or even someone within the TS family, any time we saw somebody else, the miracle of the one would appear before us. If we really mastered this discipline in our lives and made it second nature, what a difference the world would be in. Action is clearly looking outward to others, and contemplation is charity drawn inward into its own divine source. Action is the stream, and contemplation is the spring that feeds the stream. So in summary, we have two concrete steps that I've suggested: giving substantially of our material goods and seeing every person or thing that we encounter each day as a manifestation of the one, deserving to be treated with compassion and love. One is empowered over time to become one with the virtue charity, which is the key to the first gate on the path, if one can learn to practice these disciplines. Unfortunately, we must be warned that in taking such an action, we'll be perceived by the world as a fool, since our actions are, in worldly terms, going to be very foolish. Here I remind you of the Fool card of the Tarot, the Zero card of the Major Arcanum. The Fool teaches us the secret of passing from worldly intellectualism to the true ultimate knowledge and understanding, which is love. The Fool is the transition from ego consciousness to the spiritual self, or in TS terms, from the lesser manas to the buddhi manas. The Fool unites the fire of prayer and the peace of meditation. And it is this alchemical marriage of prayer and meditation that takes place in the soul of the human being who is practicing charity, altruism, and love. As one takes this step, becomes the Fool, and thus becomes the path, then one can realize the wisdom of what Annie Besant says in From the Outer Court: plunge onward into the void and you shall find it full. Spring forward into the darkness and you shall find a rock beneath your feet. Let go the hands that hold you back, and mightier hands in front will clasp your own and draw you onwards, and they are hands that will never leave you. Go out then boldly into the darkness and into the loneliness, and you shall find the loneliness is the uttermost of delusions, and the darkness is a light which none may lose again in life. That trial once faced is found again to be the great delusion. And the disciple who dares to plunge finds himself on the other side. If we can reach this stage of foolishness and plunge into the void, then our actions are charity and flow uninhibited out of the higher self. As we interface with the world in our everyday lives, we have taken the first step, as well as the last, toward living oneness. May the One grant us each peace and courage to become fools and plunge into the void, so we can enter the path through charity and love and hear the voice of the silence. Thank you.